Hello, this is the Business Marketing Club podcast. If you've heard us before, well, welcome back. It's good to have you along again. If this is the first time you've heard us, well, you're very welcome. In each episode, we offer insight and inspiration on a key business marketing topic, advice on how to climb the career ladder, and top networking tips for the business marketing community. My name's Dave Stevens. I'm a business marketer, and I'm chair and co-founder of the Business Marketing Club Community Network. In this episode, I'll be speaking to the head of EMEA Marketing at Crown Worldwide Group, Ayinde Bishi, about where to place ourselves on the scale between centralization and localization. Plus, Status Social's Mark Saxby will guide us through the enhanced post-lockdown role of social media. Sarah Goodall will tell us what skills and qualities helped her on her journey to being founder of Tribal Impact. And John Riley, the head of financial services practices at Clear, will share some great B2B marketing examples and what he's learned from them. If you're managing business marketing across countries, the temptation is to centralize and to cut costs. But that risks reducing the connection with your customers, who may operate with different languages, cultures, and traditions. So where to place yourself on the scale between centralization and localization? I'm joined by the head of EMEA Marketing at Crown Worldwide Group, Ayinde Bishi. Ayinde, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Dave. Thank you very much for having me.
So how should we define localization when it comes to B2B marketing?
I think, you know, localization for it would only apply to like global companies anyway, where you have to be in different regions around the world. So localization is actually really adapting your services, your proposition to what transcends in whatever region or country you're in a nutshell. So that's literally what it is. There's so much behind it, but that's, like a textbook definition of localization.
Okay, so take us through the advantages and also the disadvantages of taking that approach.
Yeah, and I think, I've talked about it a few times. I'm a great advocate for localization because I believe that anything worth doing is worth doing well. And it's really, really important now more than ever, because right now we have customers or consumers that are very discerning. They have lots of choice. And, you have to make sure that your proposition, your products, your services really stands out and really, stands out and is counted in wherever you, as a business, you make an investment. So, I think localization, there are lots of advantages to it because, first of all, it accelerates business development in many ways. So things like, you are coming into a target market, you're coming into a region, you're coming into a location. You can't just standardize your service and just give it like a one size fits all. That's a that's a kind of a push strategy where you're just shoving things down people's throats. If you really want to be successful as a business in any region, which is not your home region, so to speak, it's very important to make sure that you make some adjustments in terms of how you lay out what you do. So things like, translations, product packaging, if applicable. And sometimes some are low impact, some are high impact. So the advantages are that, your audience, they get to understand you, very quickly. And they get to build a brand affinity as well, very quickly as well. Because if you're going to them, you're reaching out to them, you're communicating with them in the way they understand, not only in their language and the nuances and everything else, then they start to feel that you're part of them and they kind of welcome you with open arms, especially in countries whereby they're very cultural. So we see that a lot, in this role that I'm in now and also in my previous role, where, working in places like, India in my previous role where we had to start from scratch. That was really interesting because we had that age-old argument of, do we just standardize or do we just, make sure that we localize? And I was always for localization, and don't get me wrong, there are quite a few disadvantages to it as well. Mainly cost, you know, it's quite expensive to put all those structures in place. But again, you know, it goes back to my mantra when it comes to this, anything worth doing is worth doing well. You know, you have to get the right local teams, you have to get local intel, you know, local languages, and then think of all our assets. So the website, the channels we're on, and the conversation really is how far should we go? I think that's what everybody should be thinking of when it comes to localization. How far should we go? Should we go the whole, you know, 9 yards, or, you know, should we just do some bits and then leave some bits in our home language? And, you know, again, it's not a one size fits all. It's really different from different for different countries.
So I'm guessing from the way that you answer that question that on the scale between centralization and localization, you've planted your flag very firmly in the localization camp. But for those people who are kind of neither localization nor centralization, they're kind of somewhere in between, what sort of things do they need to think about where to draw the line?
I think the first thing you need to think about is, you know, is it a product or is it a service? Right. You need to think about who your competitors are in, you know, the local market. And even if they're global competitors as well, what have they done? How far have they done? So how much work do you have to do to get a good share of the market? So I think that's the litmus test, really.
Just to kind of step back through those points. So product or service, I'm kind of presuming that you'd argue that a service needs to be more localized than a product.
Exactly. But there are some instances where, you know, some countries, depending on what the country is, they're very cultural. So maybe you might have to change your packaging. You know, maybe they're more... they're happier with bigger sizes or smaller sizes. So that's where all the market research comes in. That's where that local intel comes in. Otherwise, you're just going to go in like a bull in a china shop and just really, really do more damage, more harm than good, you know, as a new entrant to that market.
And how quantitatively do you take this? Do you actually, because we talked about the downside being cost. So do you kind of work out with each one of these situations what the cost of localization is versus its quantifiable benefit?
Yes, definitely. You kind of have to do that. But I think most times, in my experience anyway, you find out that it's always worth it. So it's always a huge outlay, because sometimes you have to do things like, you know, you have to get your local teams, you have to get your local agencies, so to speak. And, you know, believe it or not, translation is quite expensive, you know. And then also the thing about translation again is that, you know, it has to be checked. So sometimes you work with a translation agency and they do the translation. If a native speaker sees it, they'll say, oh, that's not quite right. So there's a lot of work. So don't just assume that you work with a translation agency and it's done. Some local nuances might be missed. So there's lots more work to be done, but I tell you, it's worth it, because you get more mileage, you know, very quickly than you normally would if you've just standardized. And also things like, you know, the kind of agencies you work with, you'd have to have a team somehow on the ground so that when things happen, you're closer to it, you're able to react very quickly, you know, you're able to see when trends are coming, you know. So all the things like, you know, like here, you know, in the UK, after work, you go into the city, you go out with, you know, colleagues, you meet your peers, you meet people that are competitors, you chat and you pick things up. And that's where you really pick, you know, the really golden nuggets up, isn't it? So you have that in a localized market where you have your teams on the ground. They pick things up that you would never pick up. They don't tell me things that I would never know from my office here in London. I'd never know. And that would help us quickly in the marketing campaigns.
So for those people who are just beginning on this journey of trying to work out whether they centralize or whether they localize, what's your key advice to them?
Find what works for you. You don't have to go 100% initially. Work with your budget. Work with the resources you have. Don't try to run before you can walk. And it's okay to do it start with the content on your website. Or you might just want to start with, you know, maybe just your emails that you send out. Depending, if you haven't got the resource, just pick the assets that really will work well for you very quickly. And the thing also is measure. You know, don't just do it because it sounds like, oh yeah, it's a good thing to do. Just measure. Try to see where you're getting more success, you're getting more wins. So what we do is some of our campaigns that we do, we have it in both languages. So like a split test, you know, like, you know, there's some countries where there are quite a lot of English speakers as well, but there are lots of native speakers as well in our target audience. So we do like a split test, you know, the campaign goes out in both languages and we kind of check to see what we're getting from both of them. So those kind of touch points lets us know if we're on track or if I want more investment, you know, it lets you make those decisions so that you know that you're doing the right thing.
That's great advice. Ian Debishi, head of EMEA Marketing at Crown Worldwide Group. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much once again, Dave. Thank you.
There's been lots of coverage about the enhanced role of social media during this COVID crisis, but not so much about its changed role in the new world that we're moving into. I'm joined by Director of Status Social, Mark Saxby, to guide us through our new environment. Mark, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Dave.
So first of all, tell us a bit about what Status Social is and does.
So we are a what we'd call a people agency who uses social media to get to people, using it in a purely social way, using social selling. And we describe social selling as selling without selling, ultimately understanding people, how they think, how they tick, and then using social media as a communications device. Rather than maybe just putting out messages and hoping somebody sees it, we actually try and use it in a way and teach people how to use it in a way that really helps them get through to their target audience.
Okay. So during lockdown, we've all been stuck inside and we've all been forced to use social media in 2020. Are there some examples that you can cite of increased usage over the last few months?
So it's been an interesting picture, Dave, because on the one hand, there has been 45% of people say they have been using social media more. So they're definitely turning to it and being on it. But what's been really also really interesting is the drop in engagement over social media during COVID. So although people are on it more, what they're doing is they're engaging on there less. Now, looking into that, you think, well, what's the reason behind that? I think possibly because people have got less to say. So therefore, then they've got less to post and less to talk about. You certainly see that on LinkedIn. I saw a bit of a spike in the early days and then it's kind of really waned. I've seen that across a lot of the networks. Twitter, again, really a big spike, loads of activity. I thought maybe this is the time when Twitter's going to kind of recapture itself, but then it's all died off. I think a lot of the things like the Black Lives Matters and other crises as well, and just not knowing what to say about COVID has stopped engagement because, again, people don't really know what to say and they're maybe a little bit scared of putting their foot into it. So it's been really interesting the way that social has kind of spun from being very popular to being less popular and still kind of the engagement rates are still going down, which is interesting as well.
So in that case, let's ask you to put your neck on the line in a podcast recording that's going to be out there for many moons to come, I hope. So is social in 2021 going to be just a continuation of that lockdown trend that you've seen, or are we going to go back to the 2019 model?
Well, what I've been seeing is that companies, particularly in the B2B space, are thinking a little bit smarter about social media. So I think certainly in years gone by, it was very easy for a business to think, right, all we've got to do is put out loads of content on social media and hopefully somebody will see it and hopefully somebody might buy from us. Mm. But what I'm seeing a little bit more is maybe a little bit more thinking of actually, if we're going to spend time on social media, is it the right sort of time? Is it the right sort of audience we're going for? And I think as well, because COVID, businesses didn't know what to do and they didn't know how to respond. They didn't know how to talk. I mean, I heard from one of our competitors who said they'd not had a single inquiry in the first 5 weeks of lockdown and they'd hardly posted anything because they didn't know what to say anymore. Mm. And I think that's been a bit of a shocker for a lot of businesses that they thought they're on social media. They maybe thought they knew social media, but they realize now with the fact that their businesses maybe haven't coped as well, the inquiries from social media have never really come in, and it's made them think that maybe this is the time for social media to be looked at seriously. So I would think probably in the next few years, hopefully we'll see better social media from companies using it in the right way. It might be less, but hopefully it won't be so full of the junk that we see on social media and over the last few years, which is, I think, turned a lot of people off and businesses off.
So what is better social media?
So I would say better social media is understanding the target audience first and then adapting your social media to that target audience. So one of the common things that we get is we'll have an inquiry from a company and they'll say, right, I want to be on Twitter, I want to be on Instagram, I want to be on Facebook, I want to be on LinkedIn, I want to be on Pinterest, I want to be on Reddit, I want to be on Quora, and can you help us get on all those things? And we often have to say, no, we're not doing that because it's a waste of your time. And I think a lot of the time it's because they've not really looked at where their target audience is. They've not understood the social networks to know how they work. And so therefore then they try and go on everything because they feel that everybody is on everything. So therefore they should be on everything. So I actually think the best social media is where you think, right, okay, I'm going for an audience of accountants. Where do I find accountants? Okay, well, I could find them on LinkedIn. I could find them on Twitter. But actually, where are they most active on? Are they more active on LinkedIn or are they more on Twitter? Will I find them on Instagram? Unlikely. So let's focus on maybe one or two networks, maybe even just one, and do it really well, have a really strong strategy and make it work that way, rather than kind of scattergunning ourselves, wasting so much of our time or money on people doing it for us, rather than actually doing it properly.
So you kind of start with the customer rather than start with the social media channel.
Absolutely. I think people and a lot of companies, and we were guilty of this when we started out, is that we're so focused on ourselves and what our needs are as company owners that we forget that actually social media is about the customer. It's about the client. What do they want to see? What's the value we're going to give to them on social media? How are we going to make them laugh? How are we going to make them cry? How are we going to give them education? What is that thing that's going to make them think, actually, I love this company. I love what they do. I love their products. I love their services and buy from them. We've not really been doing that. So I think if we do, customers then, what they do is we don't need to sell to them. They come to us because they love us.
So are there businesses in your mind that are doing this well now? Can you give us a few examples?
So I think the businesses that I've seen that have been doing B2B social media well are the ones who have really taken that time to understand their audience. And I think the ones that I would pick out are often more the local businesses. I don't see a lot of the national businesses doing it very well. I think the local businesses, in fact, the best examples I normally see are actually businesses that are quite small. You have a small business, you have maybe two or three people in it, but one person, because they understand the business and they love the business, and then therefore then they know the audience. They then will pick it out. They will then go out there and get opportunities. So a great example I think is a company called Oakwood Training based in Leicestershire. And they did some training with us years ago. It's such a small company, but what they did is they were so determined in terms of the way they wanted to use LinkedIn. They wanted to make it specific, wanted to make it targeted. So for instance, on their newsfeed, they got rid of all the companies and all the people on there that were never going to be a customer, and they focused on their core audience. And then I got a message back from them several months later saying they'd got in with the Royal College of Nursing, with Green King, and with somebody else on LinkedIn, all decent companies. And you think, wow, wonderful. And I think it's because the owners, they understood that using it properly was really important. And actually, if they wanted their business to grow, they also needed to use social media properly. So often I see it's the small companies, which the bigger companies need to learn from.
That's interesting. And I guess you can kind of see it in the sense that you're thinking about having a small group of quite defined, well-understood customers already that you're simply looking at engaging with in a different channel, i.e. social media. And so you can kind of see how that type of engagement would come about. If you're in a larger company where actually you've got many, many more customers, I guess there's going to be a challenge of focus.
Yeah, I think this is where a lot of bigger businesses go wrong, is that they try and scattergun themselves. So what they'll do is, again, using that word again, is that they'll have a marketing team, and the marketing team will often be tasked on things like getting likes or followers, you know, on their LinkedIn page or on a Facebook page. And clearly that's not a really great measure for a B2B business. You know, you've got to talk about, you know, what's the real KPIs here? Is it about web hits? Is it about sales? And I think, again, because of the way big businesses run, often the person who's doing the marketing isn't normally very business development focused. So the people who do business development, generally in big businesses, are people who are salespeople. Now they're generally not really using social media very well. They're kind of almost like they're on one side, and then on the other side, you've got the marketing team, and they never really cross. And actually, if they work together better as a team, and the marketing team were putting out content that the business development team were hearing from the customers, and then the business development people were then sharing their information with the marketing team, you'd get so much better results. And in getting that whole, the reality is people buy from people. And actually the salespeople using social media on an individual basis is often much more powerful than a marketing team putting out posts on LinkedIn company page and hoping somebody sees them.
Great advice. Mark Saxby, the Director of Status Social, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next up, Sarah Goodall shares a key lesson that she's taken on the journey to being founder of Tribal Impact. Sarah, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Dave. Good to be here.
So what's made you, Sarah, the brilliant business marketer that you are today?
Brilliant. Right. Well, I'm not sure I'm brilliant. I've always got room to learn, I have to be honest. But I think probably since starting the business, I have really had to understand how sales operates. I've had to really get closer to customers. And typically, if I'm being completely honest, Dave, in the last sort of 20 odd years that I've been in B2B marketing, I shied away a little bit from customers. You know, I organized the events, but then I stood back and let sales do the job. But I've not shied away of getting involved with customers. In fact, I love having conversations with customers. I'm not frightened of them anymore. And I totally understand how numbers work, you know, how revenue works, how recognized revenue works, how profit margins work. You know, I've really made it my business to understand how businesses work. And that would be probably the best thing I could share about it.
Okay. So how can others go about acquiring that self-same skill?
My advice, I guess, for other B2B marketers is don't shy away from going to talk to customers, especially if you're in an industry that maybe you don't really understand, and you maybe it's a technology industry and you're not a technical person. Don't worry about that, because most of the customers are not that technical, and actually they're asking business questions. And what you can do is just go out and listen, because that will help feed your content. It will help you get closer to the buyer journey, the help with persona building. You know, you really do have to get close to customers. And as marketers, I think it's time that we stop sort of leaving that to sales to have those conversations, and actually go on sales meetings, understand how pipeline works. Don't be afraid to ask questions that you think are perhaps maybe not, you know, relevant. Just ask all the stupid questions. I do, and what you tend to find is most of the time other people don't understand it either. So it's you know, it's worth doing that to just really understand and learn.
It's a great point, because quite often business marketers are very removed from the customer.
Yeah, I mean, I was doing a workshop recently with quite a lot of marketers in the room, and I asked them, you know, how long ago was the last time you actually spoke to a customer? And actually, most of them had never spoken to a customer.
I think,
yeah, and it really shocked me. And I saw some recent research about that as well. There's a definite thing in B2B marketing is that we just don't engage with customers. We leave that to the customer facing people to do it. Do you know what? I think actually many marketers are like salespeople in disguise. When you start to ask questions and start to talk to customers, you start to realize that this is quite good fun. And it's interesting, and you learn, and actually it's brilliant. Don't know why I shied away from it for so long. So,
and to get yourself in a position where you were able to do that, did you have to become the founder of your company? I'm aware that for some marketers, they will respond to your challenge with the comment that actually, you know, their customer facing people aren't willing to kind of let them tag along.
Yeah, that's a great, that is a great question. To be honest, I think I was forced into it because I did have my own business. And I do remember vividly when I set it up thinking, how on earth am I going to grow a business when I just don't know how to put a quote together, a proposal together? I don't really talk to customers. To be honest, I'm terrified. So I was kind of forced to the position. I had to do it. But there was nothing actually stopping me before that. You know, in my role, I could have found a friendly salesperson to take me on a sales call. You know, the people are more than happy to get you involved and to explain things. And I wrote a blog actually a few months ago that, marketers that are curious are the ones that will probably be more successful because they're not afraid to ask questions. They're not afraid to say, can I tag along? They're not afraid to learn. And I think that learning mindset is what a lot of marketers probably need to start thinking about, rather than churning through the day-to-day campaigns and getting so locked down in plans and budgets and campaigns, and you know, start getting a bit under the skin of what's going on in the business. It will make you feel better informed. So
there are lots of kind of examples of how you can go alongside your customer facing people with an excuse. I always use the whole kind of customer research excuse. Yeah. I'm conducting a survey, or I want to conduct a bit of research along the way, or something like that, as a means of being able to justify your presence there.
Absolutely. And a good way actually to start from this, rather than going up to somebody in the sales team that you don't really know, why don't you just somebody else I spoke to, they said what they did is they moved their laptop to go and sit in the sales department for a little bit so they could actually hear the conversations. So you don't have to go straight away out onto a sales call. But then once you find somebody that you can kind of tag along with and say, well, what's that proposal look like? What does a proposal look like? And you start asking questions. And then before you know it, you'll be invited to join them on a sales call, and you never know, you might even quite like it that much that you might even to move into a sales role. But it just starts with immersing yourself into that language. And I think, you know, commercially savvy marketers are the ones that are going to future-proof their careers because they understand the business, they understand how data can help that. And you've got to get that knowledge, I feel.
Sarah Goodall, founder of Tribal Impact, thank you very much.
Thanks, Dave. Thanks for having me.
There's some great business marketing out there, and I'm joined now by the head of the financial services practice at Clear, John Riley, to look at some of it. John, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Dave. Glad to be here.
So, great business marketing that we want to celebrate. What's caught your eye?
So one of the things that's really caught my eye lately is a recent campaign from Embraer, which is the Brazilian aircraft manufacturer.
Okay.
It was a campaign to launch their new aircraft, the E2. And it was a really, really standout job and led to some really standout results as well.
Wow. So what impresses you about it?
So what they did was at the launch event, they had three of the new jets on the tarmac, and they painted the front of each of those jets the color, or as if it was a tiger, a shark, and an eagle. And the campaign that they put around it was around the Profit Hunter. And it was one of those things. I think they got a famous Brazilian artist, Quintana, to do the artwork. They got a lot of fanfare around it. But what was impressive about it is it's a really great example of sort of textbook strategy. So they started with a clear goal in mind, which was to steal share from the big guys from Boeing and Airbus and close some of those brand perception gaps. They did some good customer insight, and found out that because of increasing fair pressure, the only thing that the buyers were concerned about was the ability of investing in new aircraft to drive profit. It really crowded out every other concern that potentially could have been there. And then they paired that with creative that was both standout and remarkable, but very clearly landed the point. So it was one of those things where they really just did their homework, they did it well, and all the dots were connected so that the buyers couldn't help but get the message that they were trying to land.
And it sounds like it kind of stayed focused all the way through from start to finish, whereas so often you find that marketing tends to lose its way somewhere during the process of a campaign.
Exactly. There was no scope creep here, right? It was all about how do we actually become top of mind and the supplier of choice for these airlines. And what's really interesting is that from a creative perspective, I think oftentimes our creative can be a little bit esoteric, or because we've been in the process the entire time, we can see how the creative connects back to the insight. But if you have 30 seconds in front of one of your customers, if you're lucky with the campaign, that link can be quite lost. Yeah. And so while the campaign can seem a bit on the nose, it actually really accomplished the job to be done in a very clear, very quick way.
It's very impressive. So what about you personally? What have you learned from this that you'll be applying to future work? Because I'm pretty sure that you were focused on your strategy into marketing work all the way through, given your job at Clear.
Absolutely. I think one of the big learnings for me is I think oftentimes when there's that handoff between strategy and creative, and in my world, because we're more marketing strategists, we don't actually get into a lot of campaign work. We see it as we write the brief and we hand it off, or we do the strategy and we hand it off. And then a planner and an ad agency will then redo the strategy and then hand it off again to the creative. And you don't actually get a chance to connect those dots.
Yeah.
But I think in this case, it was clear that that didn't happen. And so in my role as a strategist, I think it's stay involved in those conversations and then go back to your client and remind them of that insight as they're seeing creative concepts to make sure that, again, time-strapped B2B marketers that B2B customers, that they're trying to get the attention of, are really going to understand how that connects to the need or the problem at hand.
So never lose sight of the kind of strategy for why you put this in place in the first.
Exactly.
That's brilliant. John Riley, head of the financial services practice at Clear. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Dave.
And that's all for this episode of the Business Marketing Club podcast. Thanks to my guests, Yinda Bishi, Mark Saxby, Sarah Goodall, and John Riley. And thanks to our technical team from Through the Eye of Scott Jackson, Andrew Gration, and Josh Bench. And most of all, thanks to you for listening. Do rate or review us if you can, and email me at davestevensnow@gmail.com if you'd like to be a speaker or offer feedback. There's more where this came from. The Business Marketing Club is a not-for-profit community run by B2B marketers for B2B marketers. You can check out our other webinars, podcasts, events, mentoring, blogs, newsletters, social media groups, community groups, and gatherings for business marketing professionals and people interested in business marketing. Just go to businessmarketingclub.org.uk. I hope to see you again. Thanks for listening.